Welcome to Street TV Podcast. I'm Alex Alonso, and in this episode, I have an interview I did with Martin Corona, who has an incredible life of ups and downs. He became a gang member from a barrio in San Diego, then worked his way up into a Mexican cartel. He became an enforcer and hitman. And then while in prison, he became a member of the Mexican Mafia, which is an exclusive and powerful prison gang in the California Department of Corrections. Video portions of this interview with Martin Corona are available on the Street TV YouTube channel, but this podcast episode includes an additional 20 minutes that have never been heard. But before I play this interview, please go back and listen to the trailer episode of the Street TV podcast if you have not already done so. It's only 3 minutes and it will tell you exactly what to expect on this podcast. I would also like to remind everyone to follow the Street TV podcast on the platform you're listening to right now, so you could receive an alert directly to your phone, tablet, or computer when we post new episodes every Friday morning. If you're listening to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google, or iHeart, click that follow button. And to all you Apple Podcast listeners, leave us a rating and review. And in your review, leave me some feedback on this episode or on a previous episode or on what you might want to hear on a future episode here on the Street TV Podcast. I might just make that the next episode. Martin Corona published a book, more about that later, and I had just finished reading that book, so I start off asking him about the violence that was detailed in his memoir. So here is Martin Corona, former cartel hitman, in an episode I call My Brothers on the Other Side of the Border. There's some serious stuff in this book, man.
Appreciate that, you know.
And some of it is, to most Americans, disturbing. How do you feel about that?
Well, I can understand the sentiment. You know what I mean? I don't think too many people are comfortable with murder and contracts and people getting killed on the streets, and you know. But yet they'll pay $20 to go see a movie, you know, in the theaters where you got Arnold Schwarzenegger or Sylvester Stallone shooting them up. You know what I mean? So it's kind of it could be contradictory. It could be, you could look at it as being hypocritical as well. I was only doing what I was sent to do. You know what I mean? And it had to come. It all came from my upbringing, from how I came up on the streets. And I felt like there was a time where I was just tired of the whole game, man. I got tired of it, man. You can only see so much blood when it's. Then it starts having an effect on you, you know, unless it's something you enjoy doing. Now, you got your Jeffrey Dahmers out there and your Ted Bundys and all these dudes. They enjoy doing what they do. So they kill for the thrill. I didn't kill for the thrill. You know what I mean? I killed because it was my obligation. It was a commitment that I made. And I walked down a path that there was only, one way in, one way out. You know what I'm saying? And I knew that once I had committed myself, it was either me do mine or me get dead, you know what I mean? And I didn't want to be the victim.
So you basically worked for the Arellano Felix drug cartel in northern Mexico, right?
Yes, sir.
How did you meet any person in order to become employed by one of the biggest drug cartels during the 1990s?
Well, it happened while I was in prison. I had just drove up to Donovan. I was on a violation. And at that time, I was an up-and-coming, man. I was a rising star, man, in the state prison system, you know. So usually when I hit a yard, there were any brothers around, they would ask me to take care of it for them, keep an eye out, make sure, things ran smoothly. People got dealt with. And I had a good friend of mine there, known each other for many years, all the way back to our juvenile days, Johnny Romero from Shelltown. He had got designated, and he was being transferred the next day. So he came up to me, and he's like, "Hey, bro, I know they're probably going to give you the keys to the yard, dog, and I just want to hit you up about something, man." He goes, "I got a little youngster here, man. He's got a brother that's working down south, and he's with big people. And I've been babysitting him, man. The dude got at me, asked me if I'd take him under the wing, and keep an eye on them, and they've been taking care of me since I've had them here, man. I get money on the books. There's dope being sent every week. balling here, bro, and I just want to hand that off to you, homie. Because I know it's not something that I could just give to anybody, and I know you'll treat the kid right, you know? So I said, yeah. I said, go ahead, introduce me to him, you know? So he did, and me and the kid clicked, man. He's a good kid. First time in jail, 19 years old, got 3 consecutive life sentences, just got caught up in the game. Never been to jail before, not even juvenile hall. And it was crazy, man. I mean, when he went out, he went out with a bang, you know? And so I met the kid and took a liking to him, and we became good friends. And after about a month there in Donovan, he got endorsed to go to Calipatria. And it just so happened that I had had my my validation was just terminated because we were in indefinite shoot programs back then. Back, he's talking about the early 90s, late 80s. They used to give an indefinite shoot program where you never left the hole. You were in there. This dude's been in there for 20, 30 years. You know what I mean? And they were just terminating those. And I had got mine terminated just coincidentally. So I paid one of the clerks there in Donovan, and I said, look, man, I want to get endorsed to Calipat. I said, me and the kid, you know, I'm keeping an eye on him. I got him under the wing, and I'm helping some people out. So sure enough, I got endorsed to Calipat. And we went together, and we ended up selling up, you know what I mean? And I took care of him there. And my family and his family were coming up to visit us together. And we had dope coming in on a steady basis, and you know, there was money being put in my account. We were getting packaged up. We were just living large in prison. Everything somebody could expect in jail, we had it. You know what I mean? And I was looking out for all the fellas, man. I mean, I was on the yard, and anytime any homie drove up, I don't care where you were from, as long as you were Sureño, come see me. I'll hook you up new thermals, new sweats, commissary, you know, whatever you needed. I was breaking the fellas off. That's the way I am. You know, everybody knew me for that, being a very generous individual. You know what I mean? So, our relationship grew. You know, we were slinging dope on the yard, and we had even the black fellas, man, they were selling us all the weed, and we trading dope with them, man. And it was just, we were just entrepreneuring out there, you know what I mean? And we was having a good old time. And I started getting short to the pad, and he came at me one day, and he said, hey, bro, he goes, I never told you who my brother was, man, but my brother's Popeye. You know what I mean? And he's working down south with the Ariano Felix. And they're doing big things down there, man. He goes, and he asked me to hit you up if you'd be interested to come down there. And, I really didn't have too much going on. I had a wife, but she wasn't much of a wife. You know what I'm saying? You know, I heard from her when I came in. Didn't hear from her the whole time I was down. And a week before I go home, she wanted to show up again, come pull me out in the visiting room and stuff. So I didn't look at that as much of being a wife, you know what I'm saying? I usually don't make anybody I'm involved with in a relationship do my time with me. And when I say that, I'm like, go ahead, go do you. Then when I come home, you want to get back together, we can do that. Let's just see how much damage has been done, you know what I'm saying? You know how much water has been under the bridge. And but in her case, she took it upon herself, man. And we were married. We were actually married. And she decided to hit the bricks, you know what I'm saying? And it was all good with me. I'm not a hater, you know what I mean? I'm not gonna hold anything against her. You know, go do you.
So at this point, it's late 1992 going into 93. Martin Corona is in prison with Bugsy, who happens to be well connected to David Popeye Barron. But as Martin said, he didn't know that he was connected to Popeye. So Popeye at this time is 30 years old, a well-respected Logan Heights gang member from San Diego. He had served time in prison for murder when he was 16 years old, which happened around 1979. He was released from prison somewhere around 1989 and started working with the Ariano Felix cartel the following year. He started doing hits for the organization, but in 1992, he impressed Ramon Ariano and Javier Ariano, the top brothers in the organization, when some of Chapo Guzman's hit squad came to Christine's nightclub to murder several members of the Ariano Felix cartel. But Popeye, he returned fire, and he was also able to get the two Ariano brothers, and they escaped alive. But 8 people from the Ariano Felix organization were killed that night by Chapo's hitman. Shortly thereafter, Popeye met Benjamin Ariano, and he got promoted to head of enforcement for the whole entire Arellano Felix Mexican drug cartel organization, and he was responsible for recruiting other tough San Diego-based gang members to come work for the cartel and do the dirty work. And that's how Martin Corona got connected. So in addition to his powerful position in the Arellano Felix organization, Popeye also became a made member of the Mexican Mafia right around this time in 1992. And that's right when Martin Corona is meeting Bugsy in prison. But Popeye was on the streets. Popeye was not in prison at this time. And he was sponsored into the Mexican Mafia by his big homie, Jose Bat Marquez, another San Diego-based gang member. Martin mentioned Shelltown, which happens to be another barrio in San Diego. When Martin stated that he was getting the keys to the yard, that meant that he would be the main man on the yard, calling all the shots and basically in control of all the business on the yard. And when Martin says he was short to the pad, that just means he didn't have a lot of time left to do in prison and that he'd be getting released real soon. So now Martin has to make a decision if he wants to go down south to Mexico and work with the cartel. But will Martin get released from prison? Because he has to make a decision to go after another prisoner that can cost him his release date.
So I said, you know what, I ain't got nothing to hold me back, bro. You know, sure, let's do this. So he went ahead and contacted the fellas down there and told them, hey, the boy's good. You know, he's ready. And so we did. And he set it up. And coincidentally, like I said, we were hitting dope. And we had this white dude that was bringing it in for us. And it's so crazy, man, because his old lady, she was a cute little thing, man, from Imperial Beach. Her name was Tracy. And she bringing in our dope. She going to our people, picking up the dope. They're giving her cash for gas money, and they're breaking her off a little chunk for herself and her man. And she's bringing it to the joint, smuggling it in. We getting our issue, and we're out there putting in work. And it was so crazy that 30 days before our parole, we're in the visiting room, and I got my mother there. Bugsy's mother's there. Bugsy's wife is there. And his son is there. And we're sitting there and we're talking at the visiting table. And this kid, this white boy, comes up to the table, man. He's like, hey, bro, this is my old lady right here. So she looks at me and she's like, Night Owl? She goes, you're coming home pretty soon, ain't you? And I go, yeah, I'm going home in a month. And she's like, wow, you know, she's fascinated. You know what I mean? Wow, y'all got a lot of dope. You know, and I'm like, oh, yeah, how you know this? You know what I mean? She goes, your boy, man. Your boy showed me, you know, what was going on over there, the dude she was picking up from. And she's like, if you need anything, I'm going to give you my number. Just call me when you get out, and I can help you out. You know what I mean? And, you know, if you've been in the game long enough, you know when they, you know, they throwing their draws at you. You know what I mean? And that's basically what it was. And I think her man felt it. I think he felt the vibe too. So next thing I know, like I'm 3 weeks to the pad and I can't go out to the visit. My mother and Bugsy's mother are both going to go to a wedding that weekend. So they can't come to see us that weekend. So me and Bugsy, we ain't going to get a visit that weekend. And so I told the boy, the white boy named Thumper, man, I said, look, go on out there. I said, your wife already got that, right? He's like, yeah. I said, go out there, get that, bring it in. It's all good. We're just not going to be out there this time. You know, because we used to go out there and keep point for him, make sure the police don't roll up on him, nothing like that. And so he did. But when he came back, he was acting real funny. And his eyes was all big, like, hey, bro, there was a lot of cops out there today. I don't know what was going on, but I got panicked and I swallowed it. Well, when you swallow it, you got to wait to get it back out. You know what I mean? And I said, ain't no trip. I ain't going nowhere for, you know. I said, you got 3 days, bro. Just come up with my shit, you know. And 3 days go by. He didn't produce nothing. But I'm starting to notice dude acting real weird, man. You could tell he's high. We were waiting for crystal meth that day. And he had an ounce of crystal that belonged to us. And he was acting real weird, man. I'm like, look, Thump. You high as hell, bro. Where's my shit? You know what I mean? And I ain't got it, man. I'm trying. And his cellie co-signed. his cellie was like, man, this dude's been doing everything, man. He's been douching his ass. So everything he can do to get that dope out, but he won't come out. You know what I mean? So I'm like, all right, man. I've heard it all before, man. So I said, look, bro, just get my stuff, man. Well, I'm going to tell you what actually happened, but I didn't know it at the time. What actually happened was he did swallow it, and it had burst in his stomach. And the guy, you can't overdose on methamphetamine. Not back then. I don't know about this crazy stuff they got going on nowadays, but back then you couldn't overdose on methamphetamine. But he was getting super high. I mean, the boy was skyrocketing to the moon, you know what I mean? And he started hallucinating. And he was acting real weird at work one day. He worked in PAW, or whatever they call it, in textiles in the back. And his boss noticed him acting, peculiar, so he sent him home. And he came in the building, and we're on lockdown because we're getting ready to run chow. So they run each building individually. They run one building, and then another building. We got to walk around to the chow hall, go get our meal, and then come back. Excuse me. So the dude, came in the building, went straight to my room. And you could see something was wrong. I mean, the dude's eyes was like baseball size. You know what I mean? He's like, hey, I was walking across the yard right now, and all the fellas was whispering that when you get out, you're going to bone my old lady. You know what I mean? And I'm looking at him, and I'm like, are you serious, dude? And I was on the top tier. I was in cell 217. And I look out the window. You could see the windows. The window's kind of like your windows here. And I got up my tiptoes and I look out and the yard slammed down. And I knew the yard was slammed down because we were locked down for lunch. And I said, Thump, what are you talking about, dude? The yard slammed. Well, I could hear him whispering out there and I knew he was faking. So then I got kind of hostile. I got upset. And I said, look, dude, when we come out of lockdown, have my shit. If not, have your shit. In other words, bring your shit because I'm going to have my shit. And if I don't have my product in my hand, something's going down. Okay, bet. So he storms off. So one of the tier tenders that was out there is a good friend of mine, one of the little homies, man. And I called him over. I said, hey, bro, go get my shit. And he's like, no, dog, let somebody else do it. Because he knew I was short to the pad. And I'm like, nah, homie, I mean, I'm not going to have nobody else do my dirty work. You know what I mean? And he's like, nah, bro, man, come on, dog. I said, look, homie, just go get my shit, bring it back. So he did. He went, brought me my knife, slid it up under the door. I brought it in. I got it ready. And somehow, some way, they got word back to Industries, to Bugsy, what I was about to do. So they did the unlock for us to go to Chow. And we're headed out. And Bugsy comes rushing in. Hey, bro, I heard you're going to go whack this fool. And I said, man, who told you this? He's like, don't trip, bro. I'm going with you. And I'm like, nah, homie. I did not want to have that on my, be responsible for that. excuse me. I didn't want to be responsible for that. You know what I mean? I'm over here taking care of the kid. The last thing I want to do is get him caught up and sent to the hole. You know what I mean? I've been in the shoe. I had spent 7 years in the shoe. I know what it's like. You know what I mean? So I didn't want to take him back there with me. And so, so I said, nah, homie, just chill. But he was adamant. He was not going to give up. He was not going to relent. He wanted to go. And that was the bottom line. So I went ahead and I took him with me. And I said, all right, bro, look, you're going to hold the dude and I'm going to whack him. You know what I mean? And then you just do what I tell you to do. So he's like, all right. So we went to Chow. We came back. Everybody's coming in through the little Sally port. And I called the white boy over. I said, hey, man, come here. Let me holler at you. So I took him into the TV area on the side. And I had already told Bugsy, when I nod my head, you just grab him. Put him in the full Nelson. I'm going to hit him. You know what I mean? So we're standing there and we're talking. And I'm asking, dude, where's my shit at, man? What's all this bullshit you're woofing through the door? You know what I mean? You know, and he's like apologizing. Like, you know, hey, bro, I'm sorry, man. I'm just tripping and this and that. And I nodded at Bugs. And Bugsy just grabbed him, and I just went to work. And I started hitting him. I hit him in the neck, hit him in the side of the head. You know what I mean? And I did what I had to do. Well, when it was said and done, Bugsy dropped him. The dude was unconscious. He went to the floor. And I went straight to the cells and I started asking, is there any raza here? Is there raza here? And one of the homies from San Bernardino was like, what's up, Nida? What you need? And I slid the knife under the door and he got rid of it. And I had blood on my sleeves and Bugsy had already cut it because I told him, I said, go over there where the homies at because we used to kick it on the other side. So he went around the corner and was kicking it with the homies. And Baby Ray from Keystone was there. He was the one that called Bugsy over and told him, come hang with us. You know what I'm saying? So I'm walking down the tier after I had slid the knife under the door and I took my shirt off. I had a long sleeve boot, you know, the cambray shirts, the prison shirts. I took it off and I seen this white boy was sitting on his toilet. And back then you could check out 5 gallon buckets to do your laundry because they sold laundry detergent in the commissary. So he's got his laundry and he's doing it. And I'm like, hey, dude, stick this in your bucket. So I slid it under. He looked at it and then stuck it in his bucket. And he's like, hey, man, because it was a long sleeve and they were hard to come by back then. Can I keep it? Can I keep it? I said, yeah, go ahead. Just wash it first. Just, you know, wash it. And as I come around the corner, this dude gets up, the one I had hit. And he starts walking toward me. He's got blood dripping down on him, man. He's like, hey, man, what the fuck's going on, man? And I'm like, but the cop sees him and the gunner sees him because there's a gun tower in the unit. It's a 300, it's a 180 design. And the cop sees him and they lay down the day room. Everybody down, everybody down. They got the guns out. COs responding to alarm, you know what I mean? And the kid walks towards me, but when he lays the yard, when he lays the day room down, he lays down too, but he's seen the direction he was hidden in. So the cop tells me to lay down. He's like, you too, lay down, man. And when all the cops are responding through the sally port, automatically points at me as the culprit. You know what I mean? This is the assaulter, you know what I mean? So they put me in cuffs, and little Bugsy sees me, and this fool, the day room's laid down. When it's laid down, you can't get up because they'll shoot you, you know what I mean? This fool gets up and starts walking across the day room, you know what I mean? And the cop's on him with the gun. Get down, get down. And Bugsy's like, fuck you. That's my brother, man. You guys, that's my brother. I'm going to go lay down next to my brother. And he did. He came down and laid next to me. So they end up taking both of us to the hole. We got to write to David. Let David know we're in the shoe now. You know what I mean? I'm not going to get out when I'm supposed to get out. You know what I'm saying? And we send word out there through a little source that we had that what went down and how it went down, you know what I mean? And David's like, damn, man, I could really use the homie out here, man. This is early 92. I could really use the homie out here, man. You know, we need him, man. We need that, you know, we need that soldier mentality out here, you know? So I end up, the white boy goes to the hospital. They found out that ounce of crystal had burst in his system. He's hallucinating, you know what I mean? And they bring him back like 2 weeks later from the hospital. I'm still in the shoe. They put him in a cell right below us. So we start talking through the vent. And he starts apologizing. I'm so sorry, man. I apologize. Whoop, whoop, this and that. But I really did have it. And I was waiting and I couldn't get it out because it burst. And I'm like, look, man, all I'm saying is this. Go to my hearing, my 115 hearing, and get me out from underneath this. I says, whatever you got to do, you go in there and you tell them what you got to do. You know what I'm saying? So we did. And I was on a violation, so I had to go back before the parole board. But he testified at all of that. He said it wasn't me. I wasn't the aggressor. It was somebody else. And I got cleared. So I only did like 6 extra months. You know what I mean? On a year violation, I ended up doing 18 months. And I got out. And it was like March of 93. And there was some people sent to come scoop me up from Calipat. They picked me up, took me straight to Logan. And I was told just to hang out till somebody came from TJ to pick me up.
Fortunate for Martin Corona, Thumper, the white boy that he stabbed in prison, survived. Or else he would not have been getting out in 18 months. So he was released from Calipatria prison in early 1993. He gets picked up and he's on his way to becoming a member of the Arellano Felix drug cartel. In the next segment, he talks about going to Mexico after being taken to Barrio Logan neighborhood in San Diego. This was David Barron's neighborhood, which was formed in the 1960s. Barrio Logan operates under 4 clicas, the Red Steps, Calle 30, 33rd, and Logan Heights. So after arriving to San Diego, he's eventually picked up by Pato, aka Arturo Marcos Quiñones Sanchez, who's also from Barrio Logan. He was another San Diego-based gang member that was recruited into the Tijuana-based Arellano Felix drug cartel.
And sure enough, they sent Pato Marquez to come get me, picked me up from Logan, took me across the border, went straight to the office. And when I got to the office, I had a letter from Bugsy for David Barron, Popeye, you know. And I got to the office, met all the fellas, and I knew most of them. They were most of them from Logan Heights. You know what I mean? There was some that I didn't know, but they were from Tijuana. They were from Mexico. Some were from Sinaloa, some were from Tijuana. And got to meet all the fellas, and we're chopping it up, man, and it's all good. And they're asking me about Bugsy and this and that, you know, and it's all good, you know what I mean? And then David shows up. So David comes in, introduces himself, shakes my hand. You know, you tell the man about his business, you know what I mean? I told him, oh, by the way, bro, I got this for you. So I gave him the letter. She goes, oh, all right, hold on. So it's a trip, man, because, you know, you got to understand, when you're in the game, anything can turn on you, you know what I'm saying? And he got the letter, and he went off to a corner by himself to read it, because he don't know what this letter says, and I don't know what this letter says, you know what I mean? It could say, man, this dude ain't no good, whack him, you know what I'm saying? And I'm dead right there on the spot. So he goes to the corner, and he starts reading. It's like a three-page letter, man. He starts reading it, and I can see him chuckling and laughing. Then you can see him getting emotional, like, you know, it's hurting him, you know what I mean? He's feeling it. And then he comes back, man. He's like, hey, bro, I just want to thank you, dog. And he hugged me, put his arms around me, said, thank you, man, for looking out for my little brother. And I said, no problem, bro. I said, he's a good kid, man. He's a good kid. Up and coming, man. I can see him going places, you know? And he's like, I appreciate that, dog. I appreciate that, you know? So then he's like, you got any money? And I have my $200 gate money, because they used to give you $200 back then. And I go, yeah, I got my $200 gate money. I said, you need it? And he started laughing. He goes, nah, dog, don't trip. So he pulls this big old knot out of his pocket. It had to be about $5,000 there. And he peeled off like $2,000. He says, here, put this in your pocket, homie. And I got it, put it in my pocket. And he's like, have you ate? And I'm like, nah, not really, homie. You know what I mean? He's like, all right, well, look. You got any pussy? And I'm like, nah, homie, I haven't. You know what I mean? And he goes, well, look, I got you, homie. He goes, look, I'm going to come back. Let me go. I got to take care of something. I'm going to come back. When I come back, and he started pointing at some of the fellas in the crew, he says, you, and you, be ready. We're going to roll out. We're going to go to Mexico Lindos. First, we're going to get something to eat. Then we're going to Mexico Lindos. Mexico Lindos was like a brothel in Tijuana. You know what I mean? They had bras from everywhere. There was white bras there, South American bras there, Asian bras there, black chicks there. Everything was there. You know what I mean? And he came back, scooped us all up, and we all got cologne on, and, you know, they let me borrow some clothes, so I'm G'd up, you know what I mean? And we all head out, and we get to the brothel, man. I mean, we went and got something to eat first. We got some seafood. And then we went to the brothel, and everybody just started breaking up, doing their thing, man, because there's bras everywhere just walking around. I met this cute little Colombian girl with blonde hair and green eyes. I started hollering at her. And she's sitting all on my lap and stuff. And I'm like, look, you know, want to go to the room with me? She's like, yeah, baby, we could do that. And then she tells me, she says, look, my cousin just came in from Colombia. She says, and she's new to the game. Do you mind if I take her with us? Because she'll get nervous if she's here by herself. And I told her, I said, well, yeah, come on, bring her along. So I look at David. I said, David, she wants to take her cousin with her, man. You know, I explained the situation. And David's like, well, if you can handle it, homie, go on, take it. You know what I mean? So I do. I end up taking both the bras. We go upstairs. They got these rooms, these elaborate rooms with jacuzzis and everything. Right away, the two chicks, they go straight to the jacuzzi, fill it up, throw some bubble bath in there. We get naked. We get in there. You know what I mean? We start fooling around the jacuzzi. Then we get up on the bed, start fooling around. Like about 45 minutes later, David shows up. And I go answer the door. I'm in my boxer. He's like, and he just looked at me. He's like, you a fool, dog. You know what I mean? I'm like, thank you, homie. I appreciate it. So he comes in. He's got this shopping bag. And that thing's filled. And he asked the chick, how much? She said, $600 for each one. So he broke them off. $1,200 right there. You know what I mean? And then he goes, hey, dog, you almost done or what? I'm like, yeah, homie, I'm almost done. You know what I mean? He's like, look, I'm going to give you 10 more minutes, homie. Handle your business, because I'm going to pay everybody else's old lady. or everybody else is broad, and then we're going to roll out. I said, all right, dog, I got you. So, you know, I didn't really get to finish. We just got dressed, and I told the bros, thank you. You know what I mean? We roll out, get back to the office. When we get back to the office, Big Popeye Alfredo's there. And David tells him, go ahead, set him up. He goes, give him everything, man. And Alfredo's like, all right, I got you, bro. He goes, show him how to break down the weapons, how to clean them. Let him know the rules. Let him know how we live, you know what I mean? And just tell him, explain to him what was going on. And David looks at me and he goes, hey, homie, what do you think we're down here doing? I said, well, shit, I just thought you guys were down here moving dope. You know, and he goes, well, it's a little bit more than that, homie. He goes, we're providing security for the Arianos. And sometimes you might have to get dirty, you know what I mean? He goes, you got a problem with that? And I knew right then and there that after everything I had just been through, if I had said, yeah, I got a problem with it, I'm not down with all that, I wouldn't have left that office, not alive, you know what I'm saying? So I just made the conscious decision to just go in with both feet. And I said, no, I'm good, homie. I mean, it's not the first time I got dirty, you know what I mean? It's not going to be the last time, you know what I mean? And so I did, man. I committed myself. And once you commit yourself, you win all the way. You know what I mean? Ain't no turning back. So that's basically how I got introduced.
In that last segment, Martin mentions his original neighborhood, Bosole, which is a gang from the East Side neighborhood of Oceanside, California in San Diego County, which is north of San Diego City. And yes, their gang is named after a Mexican soup, Bosole. There's an interesting story about how this gang got its name, Bosole. If you want to know more about that history, Martin Corona writes about it in his book. I'll give you that information at the end. But there was an influx of Mexican immigrants during the 19-teens and 1920s, and it was during this time the community had the name Bosole, because decades ago, Mexican women were known to make and sell their soup in the community. So before the gang was formed, the youth in this community were actually known as Bosole East Side Kids. But by the 1960s, the group of youth morphed into a street gang. Then they began making a name for themselves during the 1970s, like so many other Southern California street gangs. They are the oldest gang in Oceanside, and they are located in the community that has seen the city serve multiple gang injunctions, with the first one being served in 1997. Now, if you've never heard of a gang injunction, they act just like restraining orders. They prohibit gang members from hanging out in public and from associating with each other. They impose rules and restrictions of constitutional rights, similar to what it's like when you're on parole or probation. But they are indefinite, and you are not required to have committed a crime to be served. So over the years, the gang injunction practice has become very controversial. In fact, in 2018, the city of Los Angeles, which invented the gang injunction, completely stopped using them. The 1997 injunction was so effective, my sarcastic voice, they decided in the city of Oceanside to serve the Barrio Pozole another gang injunction in 2010. So by the time Pozole started to receive their first gang injunction, Martin Corona was already in prison looking at all day. If you paid attention to that last segment, you found out that his nickname was Night Owl. I also thought it was interesting that Martin thought he was going to Tijuana, Mexico to help the Mexican cartel move dope. With a reputation that Martin had already established for himself in the streets and in prison, I don't think the cartel was going to waste his toughness to help move dope. The Mexican cartels are always looking for hitters. And even though everyone in the gang thinks they're the toughest, they're the meanest, they're the baddest, Martin Corona is definitely in the upper echelon of toughness. And that's exactly what the cartel was looking for. So Martin also mentioned two youngsters that was running with him down there in Tijuana named Puma and Roach. Remember those names because they're going to come up again. Okay, so for those who don't know, you met David Popeye Barron and Alberto Batman Marquez, and these were heavy hitters from San Diego at that time.
Bat wasn't around then. He was still in custody. He was still in the United States. He was in Pelican Bay doing a sentence he had picked up. I don't know if it was a violation or something, but he was still in custody. The only one I had met that day was David Barron. A year later, when Bat gets out, he comes down there and I met him as well.
This is your introduction into the Arellano Felix drug cartel organization.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Eventually, and you wrote this in your book, you admit to doing 8 hits.
I admit to doing 8 hits that I had done personally. I was involved in numerous others, but just as a coordinator or backup, you know what I mean? And but yeah, at my own hand, yeah, I did do 8 hits.
Okay, and then eventually you get arrested. Let's talk about, because part of this book and the story you tell in this book is you now as an informant. Mm-hmm. But there's a little bit of a story to that because others were informing on you.
Yeah.
And then I guess you decided to become an informant yourself was the best thing for you to do for you and your family. Mm-hmm. So take me to, you get arrested and you find out that there are people informing on you and the feds already know. At the time you're arrested, the feds already know you're connected to 8 hits?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if they knew specifically what or how what I was doing or how many I had done or, you know, any of the specifics, because down there, when you do something, you come back to the office, you're not supposed to talk about it. That's one of the rules they give you. When you come back, you don't tell nobody what you did, where you've been, you know what I'm saying, or anything like that. So what these dudes were seeing, there was some cats that had got arrested, and they were taken into custody, and they started singing. And my name kept popping up. You know, there's a guy down there from Pozole. They call him Night Owl. He's been down there for this long, and since he's got there, you know, every week, man, it seems like they're sending him to go do something, and when he comes back, they're breaking him off big change. You know, I'm talking, I've been paid $25,000, I've been paid $10,000, I've been paid $15,000. I've been paid, you know, every time you do something, you get broke off, especially if you do what you do and you do it well. And it just so happens that these dudes were watching us get this money, you know, and I had already handpicked my crew. You know, I had these two youngsters that I had working for me. I had my driver and I had my little backup man, you know what I mean, Puma and Roach. And I was taking them on everything I was doing, you know what I mean? Then I brought my little nephew down there, and he was working with me, you know what I mean, Trigger from Pozole. And he was working with me for a minute, you know what I mean? But he really didn't get a taste of anything because he ended up leaving real quick. He didn't like it. And they were just watching us get paid. They were watching me get sent because everything I was getting sent to do, it was coming out. And a lot of these dudes were getting sent to go do things, and they would come back a failure. Oh, we couldn't find them. Oh, we couldn't find a place to do it. Oh, and they were coming back a failure, you know what I mean? And David was upset with that. He used to tell me personally, when I'd ride with him all the time, we'd go driving around TJ, and he would tell me, like, yeah, these fools don't know what they're doing, dog, or they're scared, or something's going on. But there was a handful of us that were not, don't get it twisted, you know what I mean? You had some good homies down there that were putting in work, that were doing the do, you know? But a lot of them were just down there just to collect, you know what I mean? We were getting $500 a week to sit in that office, wait for radio calls, you know what I mean? You got 2 days off a week. You know, so a lot of them are down there just to collect the check. You know what I mean? They weren't as motivated as the rest of us. You know what I'm saying? But, yeah, sure enough, man, my name kept popping up. And they kept telling this to the feds. And they were gathering information. I got busted on a violation in 93. No, 94. And I go to Corcoran Shoe. And I'm sitting... You know, you go to classification when you first get there to get clear for the yard, and I'm sitting in classification, and the warden's there, associate warden's there, captain, the counselors, the unit managers, everybody's there. And the warden's at the end of the table, and he's going through my file, and he's reading it, you know. And the big dummy looks up at me, and he's like, man, is all this stuff true? And I'm like, is all what stuff? And he's like, all this stuff in here about you working for the cartel and stuff. And I wasn't even aware that they knew about it, right? And I'm sitting there and I'm like, nah, man, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, that's in my file? And he's like, yeah. Well, we have the right as inmates to have a copy of everything in your file. So I said, you know what? I'm going to fill out a form, man. I want a copy of that, what you're reading right now. And he's like, oh, okay. And he looks at the case, the unit manager and the case manager. He's like, hey, man, make sure he gets a copy of this. So, okay, and they're writing it down, man, you know what I mean? And I get back to my cell, like 3 days later, I get a copy of a violation report that was written by an agent that was involved in the investigation, and my name kept coming up numerous times. You know, he's well-trained in paramilitaristic weapons. He's been trained by law enforcement. He's working for the Arellano Felix cartel. He's an enforcer, suspected of multiple homicides. You know what I mean? I'm getting all this information firsthand. So I save it, and I take it back, and I show the boys when I get out, man, what time it is. You know what I mean? So it kind of brought a little heat on me. So, but it didn't stop nothing, man, because, you know, it just, the ball kept rolling. But I found out in late 93, early 94, that I was under investigation.
Martin got arrested on the U.S. side of the border on a violation and was sent to prison for 1 year. I just realized that while Martin has been on parole, he is not allowed to leave the county of San Diego, let alone the country. Remember that last time he went to prison and did those 18 months, that was also a parole violation. So he gets out after doing 1 year in prison and goes right back to Mexico to continue working with the cartel, even though he learned while in prison that he has been linked to the cartel and that he has been under investigation.
So when you got out from that violation, you went back to work and you weren't any more nervous now that you know that there's a file open on you?
I was a little more reluctant, but I knew I was down there in Mexico. And I'm, you know, once you got both feet in, there ain't no backing out. What am I saying? I don't want to play no more. I'm taking my ball. I'm going home. I don't want to play no more. You can't do that, because now I'm dealing with an organization that will not only kill me, but they'll kill my entire family. You understand what I'm saying? You're dealing with a multi-billion dollar organization that they've got too much to lose just because one guy's running his mouth. And I know, because I personally hit people that were involved with that, you know, that were running their mouths. You know what I'm saying? So I knew what was going on. I knew I was under investigation. By the way, let's clarify this. I never became an informant. I cooperated on a case, consciously made the decision to cooperate after I just got tired of the game. You know what I mean? I was just tired. It wasn't a matter of me facing a lot of time. I've been doing time. I got 40 years under the belt in and out of the system. You know what I'm saying? I'm not afraid of doing time. Time is easy. I just did a 15-year stretch in the feds. Time is nothing. You know what I mean? You know, we can do time easy. I know how to survive in jail. I know how to survive in prison.
But they could have had you were probably going to face the death penalty.
Exactly.
If you wanted to take it all the way.
Well, I was. I was looking at 27 to life at that time with the possibility of death penalty, because there was information that I had killed a bunch of people. You know what I'm saying? But it wasn't a matter of me becoming an informant. An informant is something that puts on a wire or goes running to the police and tells them everything he hears on the streets. I never did that. I never informed on anybody other than myself and the crimes that I committed. But in the course of me committing those crimes, I was furthering the power of the Arellano Felix cartel. So that's why it was part of the indictment. The cats that were with me never spent a day in jail. You know what I'm saying? Roach still running the streets. Puma's only in prison because he was sacrificed after that cardinal was killed in Guadalajara. Him and the homie Spanky from Logan, they sacrificed both of them. And Mexican officials took him into custody, and he's still in prison to this day. The kid was just a kid, man. He was 17 going on 18. He was just a baby, and they thought he was just going to go in, get a little time, and come back out. He's still been in custody. You're talking 20-something years later, you know what I mean? But he's due to come home, you know what I'm saying? But you got to understand something else. When I cooperated, I wasn't the only one. If you do your homework on this case, 80% of the people that were indicted cooperated. There was only a few that didn't, and there's only two of them that went to trial, Benjamin Arellano and Bat Marquez. Now, Bat Marquez caught a life sentence outside of the Arellano Felix cartel case. He caught a life sentence because he was selling dope in MCC, and they caught him. So that's where he caught his life sentence from. Since then, I understand he's picked up like two or three more just on other indictments, you know what I'm saying? But, listen, I'm not justifying what I did. You know, people want to call you rat, snitch, whatever. You know, it's funny. Me and my boy were talking about that today, you know, and And I was telling my boy, I said, you know, it's so funny how people are quick to label you. You know, that's a Hollywood phrase, man, a rat, snitch. You remember back in the old gangster day? Yeah, he's a dirty rat. You know what I mean? He's a snitch and this and that. You know, I would say, on average, most upstanding citizens in the United States that read these books, watch these movies, and see the, you know, and they're quick to jump out there and throw phrases and you know, make these comments, you know, which don't bother me, don't faze me at all, because I know what I did and I know why I did it, you know what I'm saying? But they don't understand that, like, if they're driving down the street and they say a man beating his wife unconscious on the corner, 9 times out of 10, if they're really an upstanding citizen, they're going to dial 911. They're going to call the police. They're going to say, hey, look, there's a man beating his wife. She looks like she's dying. She's bleeding all over the place. Or if they're in a gas station and the gas station gets robbed and the police come in and they were right there in the store and he says, hey, can you identify him? Do you have a statement? They're going to give a statement. I mean, these people, every day, they're upstanding citizens out there that have either reported crimes, been a witness to a crime, or you got law enforcement officers put on their uniform and go to work every day that arrest people and put them behind bar. All they're doing is being an upstanding citizen. You understand what I'm saying? Now, the criminal element, they might look at it a certain kind of way, but shoot, nowadays with this crystal meth, you got everybody's telling on each other. You know what I'm saying? And it's crazy. It's just not exposed to the degree that it's been exposed on my half. You know what I mean? Now, do I feel like I betrayed my fellow man? Yeah, I have. I betrayed him because I turned around and walked away from that life. I wasn't wanted. I never got stabbed. I never got whacked, you know what I mean? And if I did get put on a list, it was after I decided to walk away. I walked away from that life. I was in my prime. I was up and coming. Just became a carnal in the Emmy. You know what I mean? Was working for the cartel. Was making money. I was looking out for all my brothers. I was sending money up north. I was taking care of the things I had to take care of. I got nothing respect for them men. They do what they got to do. The majority of them do prison. They're going to be in prison for the rest of their lives. You have to survive, man. And I got nothing respect for all them dudes. You know what I'm saying? I did what I did because I was tired of it, bro. There ain't nothing nice about having to chop somebody up into pieces and dump it, coming home smelling like blood. Or dumping somebody in a vat of acid and watching them disappear. Or having to kill a family, a woman, a husband. You know, and I had to do all that. You know what I'm saying? I've killed females. I've killed males. You know what I mean? You know, and the people that I work with have done a lot dirtier than that. They killed an entire family. You know, there's a very, very famous case of them pulling up to a ranch, taking out 16 family members all the way down to a baby. Lining them up against the wall because the man refused to work with them anymore and spraying them all. I mean, you got like 10 gunners out there with AK-47. They just sprayed them all and killed them all. And a little 12-year-old boy survived because he hid. And he was able to tell the law enforcement what happened when they showed up. They found him hiding. You know what I mean? Then people are vicious. They're cruel. They were the most vicious, notorious cartel at that time.
There's no doubt about it that the Arellano-Felix cartel was one of the most active during the 1990s. So what exactly is a rat, informant, or a snitch? The lines between these terms are extremely blurred and there are no clear consensus when this topic arises. What Tekashi 6ix9ine did in his case, testifying against two others, is clearly snitching. But isn't testifying in a grand jury also telling? Or even telling on yourself, because it's almost impossible to tell on yourself without implicating others, especially if you're working for an organization. Well, we'll save that topic for another episode, because it's definitely worth revisiting. Remember Puma and Spanky? Well, those were the two youngsters that worked closely with Martin on several assassinations. They were also among the 20 that were present during the 1993 botched assassination of El Chapo Guzman, when they accidentally killed the cardinal from a Catholic church. Puma, Juan Enrique Vascones, and Spanky, Ramon Mendez, were actually sacrificed by Benjamin Arellano to get some heat off of him because of the accidental killing of the cardinal. Someone had to go to jail, and actually the oldest brother, Javier Arellano, was arrested and detained in December of 1993 after the killing of the cardinal, So Benjamin had to give up two shooters and millions of dollars to get his brother released. In the next segment, we learn about the two main rivals to the Arellano cartel, Amado Carrillo and, of course, Chapo Guzman. Amado was a drug lord that took over the Juarez cartel after killing his boss. He was known as the Lord of the Skies for using jet airliners to transport narcotics. He died in 1997 while having plastic surgery to his face to alter his appearance. He was 41. And Chapo? Well, he was captured by Mexican authorities and extradited to the United States to stand trial. A Mexican judge involved in his extradition was actually assassinated in 2016, but Chapo finally made it to the United States in 2017, and he was convicted on a multiple count indictment in 2019, and he was sentenced to all day.
When you was working for the Arellano Felix cartel, was most of the conflict and violence between Chapo and the Sinaloa cartel and the Arellano brothers and their cartel in Tijuana, was that like majority of all the conflict?
From my understanding, and like I said, I worked for David, but I ran with Ramon. I did security detail for Ramon, and I did security detail for Benjamin. I know them all. I met them all, you know what I mean? And I wasn't privy to all the details of you know, our allies. But I do know that they were beefing with Amado Carrillo, the Lord of the Skies, and I know they were beefing with Chapo Guzman, because we were offered $1 million if we can kill the man. I'll give you $1 million in a house wherever you want, you know what I'm saying, in Mexico. We'll build it for you, you know? And so I knew that those two were considered enemies, and we were sent out to go smoke them, you know what I'm saying? A real famous incident right there in Guadalajara Airport. They killed a cardinal by mistake. We had gotten intel stating that Chapo was going to be there. And it wasn't bad intel. It was just wrong place, wrong time. You know what I mean? And somebody seeing the entourage that was with the cardinal mistakenly thought it was Chapo's crew. And somebody said, go over the radio. And they went. And they laid it down. And they ended up killing the cardinal from Catholic Church, which just brought international heat from the Vatican all the way to every Catholic country in the United in the world. So, you know, in that game, you know, you only follow direction, you only follow order, you know, and you're not told all the information, you're not given details of everything. Fortunately, I was kind of in with some people that had juice that 9 times out of 10, every time I was sent to do something, I was told why. I was lucky like that, you know what I mean? Maybe it was my success rate, maybe it was just, you know, the rapport that we had built, or maybe it's just the way I carried myself, I don't know. But I was fortunate enough to get some of the details on some of the things I was doing.
Now, the name of that cardinal that was killed back in 93, that's Juan Jesus Posados Ocampo, and that pretty much brought a lot of heat. Absolutely. To the Arellano Felix cartel.
The accidental killing of the Catholic cardinal, Juan Posadas Ocampo, in 1993 was probably the beginning of the end to the Arellano Felix cartel. Yes, they continued to operate throughout the 1990s, but slowly the brothers were losing their power. For example, Rafael Arellano was arrested in 1993. He was eventually sentenced to 15 years, and upon his release, he was murdered. Francisco was shot and killed in 2013. Benjamin was extradited to the United States and is currently serving a 25-year sentence in the feds. Ramon was shot by the police in 2002. Javier, the youngest of the Arellano brothers, was extradited to the United States and received a reduced sentence of 23 years for cooperating. And Martin Corona, he was eventually arrested and linked to the organization, and he received a reduced sentence for his cooperation with the feds. And I asked him about cooperating with the government and why he chose to do so.
When you cooperated with the U.S. government, didn't some of the information that you had to provide was used to either arrest or investigate or implicate other members of the cartel?
Yes, it was, and I'll tell you why. Because by me implicating myself and confessing to all the murders that I had committed, it showed that my actions were a furtherance of the Arellano cartel. So the indictment was based on the Arellano Felix cartel. They weren't even in custody then. The indictments were barely being built and they had already had information before I was arrested. And then after I fell, a lot of other ones, Kitty Paez fell, Chuy Labras fell, even Javier Arellano Feliz fell, and they cooperated, you know what I mean? So they were gathering this information to build a big indictment against the AFO. And they did. They gathered enough information to build a big indictment. And then when they finally got a hold of Benjamin in Mexico, they were able to extradite him to the United States to prosecute him on.
Okay, so your book, Confessions of a Cartel Hitman, what motivated you to write this book? And did you start writing this book while you were in custody?
I was in custody when one of the agents that was involved in my case, as you know, I had cooperated, so they stayed in touch. They wanted you to come back, do grand juries and stuff, and they were the ones that were going to give me my time cut. So we stayed in touch. They were the ones that were going to go before the judge, speak to the judge, let them know that, hey, the man was truthful. He was honest. He put everything on the table. And by him giving us this information, we're able to gather enough to put an indictment together and go after these people. I never sat in the courtroom and testified against anybody. I only did grand juries. I never seen Benjamin in the court. I never seen anybody in the courtroom. I went to grand juries, and it was just me telling them what I had done. You know what I mean? And in the course of that, one of the agents and I became friends, Steve Duncan, and so we stayed in touch. And he was the one that kept me abreast of everything that was going on, all the arrests that were being made, when my time cut was going to come, and what was going on. You know, and I'll be real with you. You can talk to the prosecutor. You can talk to these agents. In the beginning, I'm like, I'm not worried about time cut. I'm ready to spend the rest of my life in here. I know the things that I've done. I'll even take the death penalty if I have to. I wasn't proud of what I was doing. It didn't give me a thrill. I wasn't out to, you know, taste the blood. I was just doing what I was obligated to do. I was fulfilling my duties, you know what I'm saying? And I didn't want to be the one on the stretcher, you know what I'm saying? So, and when I walked away, it was just, I was tired, man. I was tired of everything. Like I said, I had just got into the MMA, and there was some things that were brought to me as a new MMA member that I didn't agree with. They wanted me to go out and hit other brothers. And they're asking me, because they knew what I was doing for the Arellanos. They're like, hey, bro, when you get out, we need you to hook up with this homie. They're going to smoke this homie. And I'm like, where's the unity? Where's the where's the camaraderie? Where's the, you know, where is the love, man? Because when I was told the rules, the clique comes first before everything. And one brother cannot politic against another brother. But yet here I am being asked to smoke other brothers. And I didn't feel comfortable with that. I just walked away from the Arellano Feliz car. And I told my padrino what was going on and why I walked away from the Arellanos. He says, bro, you don't owe them nothing. He says, all the work you put in for them, you don't owe them shit. If anything, they still owe you. Because they were hearing from it. Bat was getting at him. David was getting at him. You know, they were hearing what was going on down there. You know, and so they knew. There's even an indictment with Widow Sherman where he's got written letters. And they're confiscating his leg because the guy's real, you know, he likes to put his business out there. So he's writing letters saying, yeah, we got homies down south that are working for the Sinaloa cartel. And my name came up in the indictment. It's in the actual indictment. You know what I mean? And so it was kind of funny, man, because, you know, everything that you grew up believing in was just, once you got to the other side, man, you realize it wasn't real. You know, you had brothers politicking against each other, and I didn't want none of that, man. I didn't want to be involved with none of that, man. So I wasn't on no hit list. I wasn't wanted, you know what I mean? I walked away. I was tired of it, man. I was just sick of it, man. I had just had my daughter. When I quit the Arellano Feliz cartel, it was the day they brought my child home to me. That day she brought my child home, that's the day I walked away from the cartel. David knew, I told him. And he says, well, go ahead, take a month off. I'll hit you up when we need you, and maybe we can find something for you on the other side. All right, bro, gracias. I walked away. The day I quit everything, I had another child coming on the way. And I was ready to make that decision, like, what are you going to do, bro? You're going to do this for the rest of your life and never get to see you hold your child in your arm? I mean, I deserved it. I knew what I had done. I had taken lives. I knew what I had done. I have to live with that every day to this day. To this day, I have to live with that. And it's not easy on me. You know what I'm saying? And but I deal with it. And I'm learning to deal with it a lot better. I've got a lot of know, good people around me, support crew that, you know, guide me through it, man. It gets overwhelming sometimes. You know what I mean? I've gotten high a few times because I just wanted to wash everything out. But I ended up paying for it. I got violated. I just did a 15-month violation. You know what I mean? 16-month violation for a dirty test of cocaine. You know, sometimes you want to wash them demons out your head. So, you know, you just get high and you forget about everything. You know what I mean? And so I'm not perfect. It's something I'm living with and I'm dealing with. But the reason I wrote the book is because I wanted my story to be out there. And my hopes was that somebody would read that book and say, you know what, man, this dude paid a lot, spent 40 years in and out of prison, was on, you know, parole, probation his whole life. His family didn't see his brothers and sisters grow up, didn't see his own children grow up. His mother and father was gone from them for all them years, you know what I'm saying? And I still live with the heavy burden of the lives I've taken. Yeah, I do have a conscience, you know what I'm saying? And that's why I did walk away, because I do have a conscience, you know? And so I wrote the book. I started doing conferences. I started going to juvenile halls. I started speaking at church groups. And just trying to do as much, give back as much as I can, because I can never give back the lives that I've taken. So I'm trying to do it through this podcast. I'm doing all these things as a way of making amends, of, you know what I mean? I can never get atonement. Atonement is full forgiveness. You can't forgive me for the things I've done, and I don't expect anybody to forgive me. But if I can enlighten somebody else to where they don't make the same mistakes that I did, or they don't go down the same path that I did, or if they can understand the consequences of the things that I did, the lives that I affected, not only mine, not only my victims, but my family's as well. You know, and if I can turn somebody around from that, then I feel satisfied. I'm grateful, even if it's just one person. You know what I mean? Will I live with the stigma of being a snitch and a rat the rest of my life? Absolutely. Don't bother me none, because I know why I walked away from that. You know, and I'm just trying to do the best I can to give something back. I've already taken enough, you know what I mean? I've taken 8 lives plus, you know what I'm saying? And it's something that I don't think anybody that's truly human, unless you, you know, you just a monster to begin with and you get the thrill of killing, you know what I mean? I don't think anybody could go through what I've been through and say they don't have a conscience, you know what I mean? And say that they're good with it. You know, I'm not good with it.
Thanks for listening to this episode with Martin Corona, entitled My Brothers on the Other Side of the Border. As I mentioned in the intro, portions of this interview are available on video on the Street TV platform on YouTube, but this podcast version that you just listened to includes segments that were never posted. So thanks for listening. And Martin Corona's book is entitled Confessions of a Cartel Hitman. I recommend this memoir if you're interested in this Mexican cartel history. Be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast platform, Apple, Stitcher, Google, Spotify, or iHeartRadio. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and review and let me know what your thoughts are of this episode. I read all those comments, and be sure to visit our website, streettv.net or streetgangs.com, for all the show notes, photos, and relevant links. And follow our Instagram page at street.television. That's street.television. And if you want to follow my personal page on Instagram, that's at alexalonso101.